Should we start? Hello, everyone. Welcome. My name's Kathy English. I am the co-chair of the Canadian Journalism Foundation Programming Committee that organizes these J-Talks. I'm also public editor of the Toronto Star. It's my pleasure tonight to welcome you to the first CJF J-Talks of the President Donald Trump era. That's a fact that many of us in this room never thought we'd see. It's also the topic of another night in large part. Tonight, we're here to talk about the digital disruptors, those relatively new kids on the block who launched new media organizations in recent years, and as this election cycle really showed us, have become in a short period of time powerful and important forces in the new media world. But like the rest of the old-timey media, these organizations are now asking serious questions about their path ahead, both in terms of their journalistic mission and their business model. And I think we'll talk about that tonight. Before I introduce our moderator, I'd like to acknowledge our J-Talk series sponsor, BMO Financial Group, thank you, and our in-kind supporter, CNW. I'd also like to welcome our live stream and Periscope audiences. And as always, you can follow along on our Twitter, hashtag CJFJTalk, or on the JSource live blog. Now, I'd like to introduce you to our moderator, the very smart and knowledgeable and witty Simon Haupt. Simon is a Globe and Mail's senior media writer, who's charged with covering the industry's transformation and is doing a great job of it. He began his career with the Globe in 1999 as the paper's New York arts correspondent, Now there's a dream job. Covering the cultural life of that city through Canadian eyes. After 10 years on that beat, including six as a weekly columnist, Simon joined the Globe's Toronto newsroom to report report on business in its as its advertising and marketing reporter. Simon's also worked at the CBC, and he's the author of Museum of the Missing, A History of Art Theft. Thank you, Simon, and I'll give it to you to introduce our great panel, and thank you all.
Thank you, Kathy. I would say for those nice comments, the check is in the mail, but our public editor listens into these things, so there's an envelope backstage. I'd like to welcome all three of our panelists, our esteemed panelists. The title of the evening, of course, is From the Margins to the Mainstream. If you look at them, though, you will see that they are all old enough to have originally been in the mainstream, to have then hopped the margins once those marginal outlets became mainstream. So we'll get your ages later. But for the moment, I would like to introduce from right to left, Michael Gruzek, with 380 Twitter followers, is the director of news.
Wow, it's gonna be like that.
It's gonna be like that.
Yeah.
But I'm saying that so they can boost it.
I don't want more. I want my writers to have more.
Okay. You'd be quite well introduced. Is the director of news and digital content for Vice Canada. He oversees editorial content and digital production for the various Vice verticals in Canada, including Vice News, Vice.com, Motherboard, Vice Sports, Broadly, Noisy, Thump, Munchies, and a bunch of other things my mother could not pronounce, as well as the new Vice Money. Prior to joining Vice, Michael was the executive producer of special programming for CBC News, leading the multi-platform 2015 federal election night coverage, and overseeing all international and domestic special events. He was previously the senior program producer of The National and senior producer of Marketplace, and he's won a bunch of awards which you can look up on your own. Jennifer Hollett, with 12,551 followers as of 4 o'clock this afternoon, is a self-described smash-up of digital, journalism, and politics, and as such, she's perfectly positioned to be the new head of news and government for Twitter Canada. She's worked in digital since the late 90s, first with Sony Music Canada, developing new media strategies for the label's top artists. A well-known TV reporter and producer, Jennifer has over a decade of experience at CBC, CTV, and Much Music, back when it was really much music. She was recognized by Amnesty International Canada with the 2009 Media Award for her CBC radio reporting from Israel and Palestine, and she has a bunch of other awards, which again, you can look up. Craig Silverman, with 18,426 followers.
I'm just gonna leave now, I've already won.
Mazel tov. Is the editor of BuzzFeed Canada, which launched about 18 months ago. He's also the founder of Emergent.info, a real-time rumor tracker that was developed as part of a fellowship with the TOW Center for Digital Fellowship at Columbia University. Craig founded Regret the Error a number of years ago, a blog about media accuracy and the discipline of verification, which is now part of the Poynter Institute for Media Studies, where he serves as adjunct faculty. He was part of the team that launched OpenFile, an online news startup that delivered community-driven reporting in six Canadian cities, and he's also won a bunch of awards. So just a reminder that if you do have questions or comments or criticisms, you can, of course, hit the Twitter, hashtag CJFJTalk. If you have questions for Jennifer, you should hashtag it with hashtag don't harass me on Twitter. If you have questions for Craig, you should put it in the form of probably like a Joe Biden meme. And if you have questions...
I totally approve of that.
And if you have questions for Michael, please use the word bullshit. So, Jennifer.
It's good. He's on point.
Thank you.
Yeah,
I've studied your brands for hours.
Minutes.
So we will discuss the election, as Kathy intimated. But just so you know, they didn't get all of the questions in advance. But I do need to start, Jennifer, on a scale of 0 to what the hell just happened, how much would you say Twitter is responsible for the election of Donald Trump?
Well, I, like probably most of us in this room, watched the interview on 60 Minutes, and it felt like science fiction. It felt like science fiction, seeing that Donald Trump is president-elect, despite the polls, despite what looked like a victory for Hillary, and that he was saying point blank, Twitter is a very effective form of communication, and it's one of the reasons that I was elected. That on its own isn't that surprising, because we've seen many campaigns, including Nahid Nenshi when he ran for mayor of Calgary, who was an early adopter of Twitter, and he also credited that with part of his breakthrough. So we've seen that in campaigns before, but just never at this level. And I think one thing that was really different with Trump's campaign is how he used Twitter in a way that reflected his voice. I've never seen someone running for president or prime minister typing in all caps and actually having access to his or her own Twitter account. So he definitely is a new type of Twitter leader and soon to be a Twitter president in a way we've never witnessed before.
As somebody who has run for the NDP federally, mm-hmm. how do you feel about that?
So for me, I'm a big supporter of candidates and politicians using Twitter and actually using them rather than having their staff do the tweets and have five levels of approval and back down, because I think if you use social media in that manner, it's no different than a formal press conference. And I think with the popularity of Donald Trump as well as Bernie Sanders, we see there's a big desire for politicians who are speaking from the heart and using regular words like regular people and are driven by passion and are off script. And that's what people look for in Twitter. Twitter is at its best when you can see that the lawyers are not involved and the publicists are not involved and that you're actually connecting to someone, especially if that person has power and influence. So we see it in politics, but as well with celebrities and other people we normally don't have access to.
That idea of speaking as real speak, as real people speak, as opposed to, I guess, the way we would quote them in the Globe and Mail. Is that one of the strengths, Michael, of Vice, the idea that you are unfettering your reporters, your editors, to speak in the way real people speak?
Well, several of them are here tonight, and they would not say that they feel unfettered, because we actually put a tremendous amount of work that I've got great pride in terms of how much editorial diligence we do around everything. But our voice is very important, and I think it speaks to what is going on right now in the aftershocks of what we saw last week. I think we could all feel the shift in trust and questioning in mainstream media over the last several years, and Vice has found a niche to cut through based around authenticity and calling it like it is. And yeah, we use the word bullshit in a lot of our headlines, probably too many, which I've pointed out, but at the end of the day, people don't want any more bullshit, sorry to say it a second time, because they've been sold to, they've heard filtered messages through other people, they've been told what to think. And a commitment that we have at Vice is to keep it connected to the story, cut through, talk to real people, actually go places, actually get out of the city and go to these places and report on it. And that's expensive, hard work. It's actually the foundations of what the best journalism in the world is. So I often feel there's a bit of a gap when people talk about Vice going and doing this seemingly badass journalism out in the field, that it's some sort of new thing. It's actually the foundation of the greatest journalism in the world, and that's been pointed out to us by great journalists, and we're cognizant of it as well. We're just trying to keep it up.
Sorry, I was thinking of David Carr. Yes.
That moment.
He also followed up with a piece which wasn't as well quoted before he passed away, celebrating Vice for the entrepreneurial spirit of their journalism and saying that they are engaging in doing, especially on foreign affairs, getting places, showing people some of the things that they need to see, which I do want to say is not something that only Vice does. I mean, I'm looking at Margaret Evans from the CBC in Aleppo right now and just going, that's what we all need to be doing, is showing people what's going on in the world and getting, no offense, Jennifer, but getting away from processing everything through the shareable kind of process that we're in around Twitter. Now Margaret's also been tweeting about her time in Aleppo, so that's a great thing too.
We also have a 9-year-old tweeting.
There you go. But this kind of journalism is harder to do possibly than ever, and we're committed to it alongside all other organizations.
Craig, what would you say are the strengths of BuzzFeed? We were talking about the authentic voices. It seems to me that's, as long as you can put it in listicle form, authentically.
How many minutes did that take? Okay.
four and a half. I'm done with the list.
I think there is, you know, when I think of BuzzFeed, like, I think there is sort of an overarching voice around it, but I also think of multiple voices and approaches. Like, you know, we have a news organization, and then we have an entire entertainment organization, and they have very different approaches, but we also will share and sort of learn from each other a little bit. So I think that the biggest thing for me in actually looking and why I wanted to join was that I saw a company that started in one place now 10 years ago, just trying to figure out what spread on social media and just like curating and grabbing things and not always, you know, doing it in an appropriate way, to an organization that now, you know, suddenly they started to do video and that became a huge thing. Tasty, which is now has like, I think it's like 90 million fans around the world, didn't exist 2 years ago. And so for me, that's the most appealing thing, is a place where people are really, really, like, we have this rigorous thing about trying stuff that really is encouraged. So I think that's actually the biggest strength, especially right now in media where it's just constant change. If you have an organization where the culture is getting people to try things, figuring out what's working, and then really diving in on it, I think that's good. And it can also go the other way, where we will do stuff to death, is probably, I think, one of the criticisms of us that can be valid, is like, we'll do something to where like, yeah, that's not working anymore. And some people will be like, oh my God, please stop, you know?
You just mentioned Tasty without actually telling people what it is. First,
well, I just assume everyone knows.
Okay,
I guess.
Well, no. So let's, and I probably should have started with this, and it's possible my father is watching the Twitter for CJF J Talks.
Yeah.
Hashtag CJF J Talks in case you want to ask any questions. Could you drive for me? What BuzzFeed Canada is right now, and the reason I say right now is because, of course, it's shifted over the past 18 months, and frankly, Vice Canada itself has also shifted over the past couple of years, and Twitter shifts all the time as well.
Just the last few seconds.
Fair enough. Yeah. But anyway, so could you draw that out for me, just in case not everybody is fully aware?
So BuzzFeed, basically, we have two main parts of the organization. There's one, which is BuzzFeed News, which is journalists doing journalism, foreign correspondents around the world, 20 people spread out between the US and UK on an investigative reporting team. I think they have two Pulitzer winners on it. So that's, you know, a digital news organization. Then we have what's called BuzzFeed Entertainment Group, which does not do journalism, which does the videos you see on YouTube of people tasting, you know, trying weird candy, or videos of people talking about the first time they did this or did that. And that includes a whole group now that where they create new brands that aren't called BuzzFeed this or BuzzFeed that. And one of them is Tasty, which started, I think it's like a year and a half or maybe 2 years now ago, of just shooting like this top shot of somebody making a simple recipe. And they started making these videos and they went crazy. And now Tasty is, I think we have it in like 7 countries. And it's just recipes. Mm-hmm. But there's something about the style and something about the accessibility of it that has just been insane. And it's the biggest Facebook page we have. And it exists pretty much solely on Facebook. And I checked the numbers recently because I've been trying to get them to do a Tasty Canada. It's not happening yet. But there are almost 2.5 million Canadians who've liked the main Tasty page, which is insane. Like, I don't know how many pages there are in Canada that have that many. So BuzzFeed has these two sides to it. We have news, we have entertainment, and there's all these sort of sub-brands now, like Tasty and another one called Goodful, that are being launched all the time.
And Twitter just partnered with BuzzFeed for our election night coverage. So of course, Twitter is still the 140 character tweets and the hashtags and the conversations around what is happening right now anywhere in the world. But we have a big commitment right now to video. So moving away from the second screen experience, you can actually watch what you're talking about on your phone. So with the US presidential election, we partnered with Bloomberg for the 3 presidential debates and the VP debate. And for our election night coverage, coverage, we partnered with BuzzFeed. A studio was built in New York, and you know, that was part of our coverage, especially targeting a younger audience. People were naturally going to turn to Twitter on election night to see what the results were as they were coming in, as the states were being called, what the different news organizations were saying, but they could actually watch the election coverage. And that was a fun partnership to see come together, especially from brands that, for digital natives, are just part of their day-to-day source of news.
Yeah, I mean, they did build, so the sort of canteen in the New York office was completely turned into a studio. I think they had maybe 30 days to put together this, I think it was like 5 hours of programming or something.
You didn't
like
know the election was coming before 30
days? No, we were looking at corgis, so we weren't really paying attention. And
they're so cute.
They are, they're wonderful. but I don't know all the deals of the deal and how that all came together, but it was the deal was done relatively close to the election, and it was all pulled together really quickly. And you know, so that was, I think that was a first of probably what will be a bunch of things of BuzzFeed doing more like that. We now have our own video division in news, which didn't exist like 6 months ago. So that's a big priority.
Michael, could you just sketch out Vice Canada now, because it has been obviously changing over the past couple of years. What is it now?
It's growing right now. Vice can be confusing to the outside. It's so quickly, though, you know, it started as a Canadian publication, punk street magazine in 1994 by Canadians, Shane Smith and Sarush Alvi. And at just about the right time when we were seeing that need for video was when Vice was getting into video in quite an aggressive way and just saying, look, we write all these incredible articles for our magazine, and the pictures behind them must be as mind-blowing as the content, so let's just get a camera. And from there, we saw tremendous growth in video. Outside of, so that's what we call Vice Magazine or Vice.com, and that voice is still very true, and it's the main, a bit like BuzzFeed in the sense that it's split into the more, if you will, kind of serious news divisions and then the more culture divisions. We have that separation. Vice.com is the main hub into the main world, and that's where that main voice from started in 94 still lives. We have all these different divisions. You have Tasty, we have Munchies. We've got Sports, we've got Noisy, which is music, Thump, electronic music, Broadly, which is focused on women's issues, and we're growing all the time. We just launched Vice Money between the US and Canada. In Canada, we just launched it on Monday, actually. And then news, I can speak about. News is probably one of the fastest growing divisions that we have, led right now by the fact that we have a tremendous partnership between HBO in the United States, and it runs on Viceland in Canada for a nightly news broadcast. So we now have a 30-minute nightly newscast that Vice News is presenting, fully serviced by the Vice News team. In addition to that, if it wasn't confusing enough, or if that wasn't enough, we also have Viceland, as I just mentioned, which is our television network, which will be available in dozens of countries within the next couple of years. It launched in the US and Canada last year, just launched in the UK. Launches today, I believe, depending on what time it is in Australia, featuring a documentary produced by Vice Canada. In Canada, we have roughly 200 employees and growing. A large number of those employees are dedicated to the Canadian production for Viceland shows, which are distributed internationally. On the editorial side, we're actually fairly small. I'd say that mixed between video and all of the various writers and editors, we're roughly around 40 people. But that's constantly shifting. We also just launched, I could keep going on, we also just launched Vice Quebec in September and reopened. It was kind of a nice full circle, reopened a new office there just a week ago, which is full circle from when it started in 1994. And I tell you, the office there is nicer than whatever Sarush and Shane had in 1994. And there's roughly about 20 people in that office. Editorial-wise, probably only about 4 or 5 of them, though.
And we were joking, Craig and I went to university together, did our journalism degree at Concordia, back when Vice used to be Voice.
That's right.
And you did a couple of pieces
them. I wrote, I think, at least 2 and maybe 3 when they were mostly just a magazine.
You said you weren't paid yet? You haven't?
No, I got paid.
Oh, you did?
I got paid. Right. I think it was $50 an article.
It does come in the mail, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So you're doing lots. Obviously, but now again, as we've established, all three of you have shifted over to your respective organizations. Really, just in the past couple of years, you all have very traditional, dare one say, legacy backgrounds.
I was never a scold.
Yeah, more legacy than that.
I did this because I've spent most of my career being self-employed. So I've mostly, I used to do a weekly workplace issues column for the Globe and Mail, but that was freelance.
You don't get more legacy and establishment than workplace for the Globe and Mail.
It's true. Yeah. No, but I've either been self-employed or at a startup, strangely.
All right, fair enough. But also a scold.
And a scold.
So given that, obviously you guys the three of you have hopped over to the hot new thing as it's entered the mainstream. Do you feel individually that your organizations don't get the respect that you deserve? Craig, do you want to take that first?
It depends. It depends on the group. So maybe sometimes. But I also think, I said before, started 10 years ago, wasn't doing journalism. It started as an entertainment company. It wasn't thinking about journalism. So the idea that we still have to earn some credibility in journalism is totally fine, as far as I'm concerned. And I think that for people who are younger, who've been growing up with BuzzFeed, there's no barrier to that at all. For folks who are a bit older, my age and older, who didn't grow up with BuzzFeed, and often who I think work in the industry, there's still a bit of a skeptical eye.
Sorry, how old are you?
I'm 39. You don't believe me?
I will check your Kenyan birth certificate later.
Please. Okay. It happens. But I think if you allow that to, but like, it's, I was going to BuzzFeed. Like, I know listicle jokes and catch it. Like, that's part of it. But also, our biggest post this year globally is the letter that the Stanford rape victim sent to her rapist. And we got that first because we have two reporters dedicated full-time to reporting on sexual assault in the United States. And one of them developed a relationship with her and got that. And so, so I can point to that, but yeah, there's tons of lists and other things. So there's definitely situations where that's the case, but I also think it's just over time that will change. Okay.
I agree that it depends on the audience, because if you are at any press conference or if a big explosion happened right now outside, everyone checks their phone, they check Twitter. Right. We say it's where the news get the news. We have this image from CNN where it's all the CNN reporters looking at their phone, right? So in news, we definitely have the respect because it's where news breaks first, and we're seeing news come up rather than come down from traditional media. But at the same time, I've worked in social media doing consulting enough to know when I cross the border, and I say I'm a digital strategist, right? It's like, what's that? Or, I was on a plane, someone asked me where I work, Twitter. Well, you just do tweets all day? So there still is just a misunderstanding on what those of us do in digital, like what we actually do minute to minute. I think people do see it as just very organic and not realizing the scale that we're operating at.
Michael, do you guys get the respect you deserve?
We get, we get the respect we deserve from our audience. We know who our audience is. We wouldn't be as successful as we are with the numbers that we have if we didn't. We have challenges in the sense that a lot of people outside of our audience are trying to define us, and I understand why. I have a gut feeling now that I've been there for a good bit, that we're perceived as threatening, and if we are to mainstream media around certain projects, I think that everyone should just look in the mirror and say, if there's an opportunity for a market because somebody is doing something else, then there's an opportunity in the market. Doesn't mean we're competing with you directly, but there are definitely attempts to define us without understanding what we are, which I understand is confusing, because when you look at Vice, we've grown so quickly. We're kind of like that massive plant that suddenly emerges, and you just don't, where did that come from? But if you saw it, follow through, and for a lot of us, for the ages that we're at, because I imagine you're still going to ask Jen and I how old we are too, we saw it grow up. I remember shopping for sneakers in downtown Vancouver when I was in my 20s, and going home and reading the do's and don'ts at the back of Vice, and and laughing and thinking, this is the greatest thing ever, and being proud that it was on my coffee table when my friends would come over,
because
that was
when
I was cool.
Were you on the do list or the don't list?
Well, I loved both. I was definitely probably on the, well, actually the don't list was always so offensive and often involving inappropriate clothing mishaps, so I won't answer that question. But listen, we have work to do around credibility. I'm not blind to that. I talk to our team, especially our news team, talk about that all the time. You know, the big thing that I would say is that people say to me, so what's it like? You were at CBC forever, and now you're at Vice, and it's this hip, cool place with a really nice office, which is true.
That's true.
It's really nice.
And Craig can verify that.
It's beautiful. But
I haven't been to their office.
Yeah. You're welcome to come by. The thing is that the work is the same. This is the thing I want to really hammer home. The work is the same. You've got people that are agonizing to do the right thing every day for their audience. And they're trying to get it right. And they've got different tools, different sizes of teams, maybe different layers of management, who they report to. But really, we all wake up the same way at Vice that I woke up when I worked at CBC, in the sense that we were in constant pursuit of just trying to make sure we were on the right thing and doing it in the right way. And so we're not that foreign from one another.
And how old are you?
I'm 43.
Jennifer?
41.
Thank you.
I'm the youngest. This is not my experience in my office every day, believe me, okay? This is great. I'm going to enjoy this.
I'm one of the oldest at my office, and I used to be one of the youngest, so that's a whole other conversation over a drink.
It happens to all of us. Do you guys believe you've become part of the mainstream? I'm going to get away from that word in a second, but was that a goal? Is that a goal? And again, obviously, you've only been there for the past couple of years. Is that a goal? And because it seems to me, frankly, I'm not sure there is a mainstream anymore. We can refer to legacy media, mainstream media, centrist media, whatever you want. But it appears to me that in part because of the work of your three organizations, there has been a gravitational shift. The mainstream has obviously eroded or shifted. Do you even think about it in those terms?
I mean, yes and no. I think there's the respect and credibility piece, I think, on the news side, where maybe you wonder, like, at what point have we been around long enough that people will, you know, just sort of see that? But, you know, at the same time, you know, BuzzFeed is already, if we think globally, it's already really quite large. So I don't know, like, what more has to happen. And in Canada, like, we have a small team here. We have 7 people in editorial. We have 4 people in business. And BuzzFeed, according to Comscore, is, like, one of the 10 largest media sites in the country. So, you know, I mean, we could hire 2 or 3 times more people and try to be in the top 5, but, you know, I don't know that that's going to make a huge difference. It's already quite large. And I don't view it in opposition to the mainstream, particularly with the situation in the media in this country, where there have been a lot of layoffs, where there are a lot of good journalists who don't have the jobs I think that they deserve, to try and view it in a way of, you know, wanting to take over or what have you. Like, I think, you know, especially at the local level, we need more of everything. And I wish we were, you know, doing more on the local level. We're not, and I don't see us doing that anytime soon, you know?
I see Twitter as a mainstream platform. Twitter, the bird, has 99% brand recognition. And when I watch the evening news, I see tweets from Hillary Clinton and tweets from Donald Trump in the story. So people are definitely familiar with what Twitter is and what tweets are, but I think why we're still having this conversation is because people, and this is the beautiful part of Twitter, use Twitter in so many different ways, right? So there's still a lot of grassroots movements and voices that are often overlooked or ignored on the platform. Anyone can create an account. So it's big and small at the same time.
I know you've got to go next, but I mean, is that really why we're having this conversation, or is it because Twitter, frankly, has its issues, be it harassment or fake news, you know, obviously facilitates the spread of fake viral news, not nearly as much as Facebook, so I'm sure you're relieved that, you know, it came to be, the spread of false news came to be known as the Facebook effect and not the Twitter effect, but, you know, and you cited corgis, obviously there's a whole lot of bullshit advice. I mean, so, quote unquote. So
there's worse than that sometimes.
is that really why we're having the conversation about what is mainstream, whether you guys are mainstream, or is it because you, all three of you, are saddled with some significant issues?
Yeah, so I've worked for a variety of media outlets and have face challenges and opportunities at all of them. So I think as you get bigger, as you become more relevant, you have challenges that you have to take on. And absolutely, like this morning, I was doing a lot of media interviews around our latest product and policy announcement in regards to user safety, and that's the muted keywords and right. conversations, and making sure that we're enforcing our policy. And
do you want to just draw exactly what you mean by
yeah,
that?
Yeah, sure. So we're really aware at Twitter that harassment and abuse is an issue, and we've not acted quickly enough on that. So today we rolled out two new features, which is the ability for users to mute keywords of their choice, as well as conversations from their notifications, but as well updating our policy. And Twitter is always going to be a platform for free speech, but we have a commitment to making sure that it is a safe space and being able to crack down and take reports of abuse and harassment, racism, sexism, the list goes on, in reference to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And this has been a top priority for Twitter. And it's something I know that's not limited to Twitter. It's something that you see in the comment sections of most news websites. It's something you see at the bottom of a YouTube video when there's a baby laughing. But it's really important to our platform because at the heart of what Twitter is engagement in a conversation, right? So we have to make sure that that's a productive one. So yeah, that's a challenge. It's one we talk about openly. It was something that was a big part of my interview process taking on the job. I'm on Twitter as a feminist. Something that's drawn me to this space is finding solidarity in movements. But I'm also aware I'm a woman. I'm a white woman, so I don't face the same issues as a racialized woman or a queer woman. But yeah, it's a challenge. And it's a challenge being a woman out in society at large. So these are things that Twitter takes on. But I feel the challenges also existed when I was in mainstream newsrooms. So the bigger you become and the larger that impact is, there is a responsibility that comes with that.
Again, hashtag CJFJTalks. If you've got any questions, comments, criticisms, please don't harass us. Michael, did you want to?
Yeah, I mean, I'll build on that, because I think that the point is that as you grow, you figure out what you haven't dealt with yet. And in my time at Vice, I feel like we keep opening doors and going, oh, we haven't thought about that yet. Now we better figure that out. That's exciting, because we're constantly suddenly, moving into live television, doing more video than ever before. But when it comes to serious policy issues, it's something that, in my time at Vice, I've taken very seriously. I just rolled out a couple weeks ago our Vice Canada Journalistic Standards and Practices, because it didn't exist before. It's not as robust as what you might see at BBC or the New York Times, but it exists now. It just wasn't there before, and we will honor it. And just like new policy that you guys have put out, you sometimes have to quickly adapt and say, we need to come up with a plan for this, because we do need to be taken seriously, because we are taken seriously. So we're running a content business, and we need to maintain that trust. The big challenge that we have as we grow and we open doors and realize that we haven't solved that one yet is how we balance that with the, with the kind of rogue, kind of muckraker original spirit of Vice. And that's the challenge that, I think I talk about it probably 5 days a week with our head of content, Patrick McGuire, who's been there for several years, is it our voice? Is that who we are? Should we be doing this? Should we be doing that? But in a way, that's a fun conversation. The harder conversation is growing a business, protecting employees. We've had several issues with employees where I feel they've been abused through social media. It's unacceptable. How do we deal with that? We're a company that has an HR department of only two or three people. We're figuring these things out as we go, but we're committed to addressing all of these issues as they come up.
Craig, you said earlier that you feel that there's a kind of commonality rather than an old-fashioned competition. It used to be that newspapers in three or four newspaper town like Toronto, they would each compete and have very sharp elbows. The sense is not the same anymore. That in fact, often we're working together. Michael, I know you've done partnerships. Jennifer, of course, Twitter has done partnerships with news organizations. But I'm struck by the fact that, Michael, you were in Ottawa earlier today, sitting, I presume, next to my publisher.
It was one seat over from
me. One seat over, because in the middle, was it Brian Lilly?
It was Brian Lilly from Rebel Media.
So I just, that's
a
unfortunately.
Great image.
Isn't that great? There are photographs if you want to.
Are there photographs? Because in fact.
Are they on Twitter?
Well, I didn't post them.
Because there was no live stream. Normally it was a live stream. I had to listen to audio. It was like the 1920s again. I was sitting by the fire listening to the radio. So the Globe's publisher, this was a Canadian Standing Committee on Heritage. Talking about the state of media and my ultimate boss, Globe's publisher. No, my ultimate boss is you, the readers. But other than that, the Globe's publisher said to the committee that he didn't believe CBC should be straying into the business of digitally publishing opinion. Rebel Media's Brian Lilly, of course, said that CBC, agreed with Mr. Crawley and said that CBC should, quote, stick to its knitting. I'll leave that phrase to you guys to interpret as you will. In addition, CBC should not even be doing digitally based local reporting in places like Hamilton, which obviously has faced cutbacks. I'm curious to know, you've worked at CBC, the view of each of you regarding CBC, its role in the ecosystem, and vis-a-vis your individual organizations.
I'm happy to jump in first, since I was living with some of these ideas today after being in Ottawa. There's a lot of conversation about competition and conversations about threat. And these are the words that get used. And it's unfortunate, because what we see, and I think I made this point earlier, is that there's opportunity for us to all have these voices that add up to a whole. And I always try to look at myself, and I've said this to our writers sometimes, like, look at your own behavior. Just think about what you did today. For me, because I'm old enough, I do have a newspaper. It is The Globe.
Thank you.
I get the Star on Sundays. That arrives on my front porch, and then I am on Twitter, and I'm looking at BuzzFeed, and I'm checking out what we're doing at Vice, and I'm looking at a bunch of stupid stuff I probably shouldn't be looking at as well, because we all do.
And listening to a podcast.
Yes.
And CBC Radio.
Now, always Matt Galloway. But the fact is that we have an ability to, as audiences, take in a lot of different sources. I think that notion of knowing what lane you're in and figuring out what lane you're in and what your unique offering to your audience is something that's a challenge for all of us, and something that CBC, as such a massive institution, will probably continue to grapple with for many years. But it's the same challenge that we have on a smaller scale. I mean, they have obligations that they absolutely have to meet, and they meet them very well. And we do not feel like we're in competition with them. We feel like we are a complement to the great service journalism that exists through public broadcasters. And we'd say the same thing in the sense that we're a complement in the U.S. to the New York Times, who is practically unbeatable. We wouldn't even compare whether we're taking on the amount of journalism that they're taking on. But we provide a different voice so that an audience can still see that range of voices. Now, this is an interesting conversation, because having a range of voices, hearing a variety of thoughts, this is the exact idea that we realize has been under attack in the last week, and we're understanding why based on algorithms, and I've been seeing some amusing comments from my friends saying that they're like looking for a friend that they don't like so that they can start to see what they're sharing on Facebook, and you know, how you can partner up with people who have opposite views of you so that you actually have a more informed view of the world.
Is it really that difficult?
Well, the fact is that we do have echo chambers, and I think that we even have echo chambers within our own organization sometimes, where we're only reading what it is that we do and processing it through what we do, and that's something that we have to work on. But to your point about the CBC, I mean, I think that they're an institution that Canada and everyone should be proud of, and I'm not just saying that because I worked there for years ago. That said, there must be room in this country for more voices, and I think that we're all proving that there's work and there's journalism to be done. They can't do it all, and they shouldn't do it all.
So So I thought knitting was still hipster. Like, isn't that kind of a compliment?
But it's either hipster or feminist.
Yeah, in which case, to me, it's good. That's
in which
good
case
stuff,
it's still
right?
bad for Brian Lilly.
But I also worked at CBC, and while I was at CBC, I was a cross-platform reporter and producer on Connect with Mark Kelly, and this was part of the rebranding of CBC News Network, and we actually worked together there. And that was an experiment, and it didn't last. The show was canceled. But it's really important that the public broadcaster, whether it's CBC, BBC, anywhere in the world, is experimenting, is trying new things, is trying to figure out how to connect broadcast to digital, to public outreach. And I think the unique opportunity and the beauty of a public broadcaster is they have a mandate to represent the voice of all citizens in a way that private companies don't. So yeah, there actually are a lot of opinions and point of views that we don't hear from Canadians. We still have a very white mainstream media landscape. We also have a Toronto-centric media landscape. And if the CBC can bring in new voices through an opinion project, I think that's a great thing. I would be concerned if they weren't trying out new things. That, I think, is the larger fear.
Anything?
I've never worked at the CBC, I guess I should say that. I haven't spoken to anybody at the CBC about sort of their thinking around this. My gut reaction was that personally, I wasn't so enthused about it. And there's a couple of reasons for that, I guess. The first is that the motivation of bringing more voices is a good motivation, but I think there are lots of different ways to do that. And I realize that money that's going into this here in Toronto can't necessarily instantly be given to Newfoundland or to regional centers around the country, but I think ultimately, if you have a finite budget, which they do, you have to make choices about things. And my personal bias would be that I think, particularly because of the collapse of local journalism around this country, I would rather see investment go there, and I would rather see those voices getting amplified. I would rather see CBC Indigenous getting more funding than opinion. And I don't know necessarily what the motivation is, because one piece of it is that when you look at how opinion-driven content performs, I was doing some analysis today, particularly around the US election, some of the top stuff from mainstream organizations in the US about the election was opinion. And so I think that as much as there's amplifying voices, I think CBC also has a desire to grow and to expand digitally, and they see this as an area that drives engagement and drives traffic. And again, I haven't spoken to anybody there. I don't know which things are being factored in, but I think that's part of it. And I, personally, if all things being equal, I would rather see money going into another part of what CBC does, acknowledging that the budgets don't necessarily work that way. I realize that, but at this point now it's happening. We'll see how it goes. I do think that some of the backlash they've gotten has been a little bit ridiculous at times. I mean, people instantly saying, oh, CBC's getting in the hot take business. And it's just, who doesn't publish hot takes today? Okay, so first of all, like, look inside. Everybody's doing it. And to assume that, they're not going to publish stuff that's good, considering they're paying, I think, a very competitive rate is the other thing. So for people who do that kind of work, this is good. But I'm not crazy about the backlash, even though, frankly, I'm not a huge fan of the idea myself.
In a Q&A with JSource, Michael, you were asked about how Vice reaches millennials. And I'm going to quote you if you don't mind. And you replied, quote, we do know there's an interest in anything that feels authentic or raw or real, and we obviously have already touched on that a bit. I don't think it's just millennials. I think it's just as a media society we're so accustomed to and suspicious of filtering. With that in mind, I'm curious to know what other legacy, what frankly legacy media, like the Globe and Mail, like CBC perhaps, and like whatever newspapers are still going to be around a few years from now, what do you think we can learn from the three of you?
To pick up on Jen's point, the diversity of voices. There's no newsroom in this country that can proudly show a photograph of their newsroom and say it's representative of Canada today. And that goes for us at Vice Canada, and I'm confident that it goes for the Globe and Mail and others. And that's something that we need to work on. Very clearly, and I can't think of a more urgent time to do that. By hiring people and growing new voices, you're informing story selection. It's like, you know, one of the most frustrating things that I saw when I worked at CBC is we had these wonderfully talented and diverse associate producers who are the most junior people in on any show. And you know, when I would see them start to condition themselves and not pitch the stories that matter to them in their lives. And that's something that at Vice we really want to encourage is tell us, I'm now an old guy, so tell me what matters to you, because we are facing the urgency of that authenticity kind of crisis that I think we're dealing with there, where people don't trust that anyone is writing for them anymore, doing it for them, and it's all just, to quote Vice, bullshit, right? And I think we saw a little bit of effect of that in the U.S. last week. So we need.
Sorry. In the U.S., you felt that election was a vote on non-whites not being heard.
I think that there's a distrust of the media that in the days after the election, mainstream media accepted that whatever they were doing may have not been enough to cut through based on the fact that they were reporting based on truth. I accept that. I'm not so much of a conspiracy theorist to believe that mainstream media has some sort of conspiracy, but there are enough people out there that believe that they do. There's an opportunity. We do it more through video, for sure, you know, and that gets to craft in the sense that the way we treat video stories is not all pushed through the lens of what a reporter thinks about it or feels. You don't have to always see the reporter, hear where they're going and what they want to do. Sometimes that makes total sense and they're the vehicle to take you somewhere. But we would like to think that our audiences, well, we do think, we know our audiences are smart and they get it. They don't need to have every piece of information set up for them. They know what things are, what things look like. And so we put a big emphasis in our video storytelling as well as in the voice of our print storytelling of trying to just get rid of those filters that then may lead to distrust. And I do think that's something that other media should be learning from Vice.
So retweet to the point on reflecting Canadians and making sure that that's not just on air, but also like throughout the newsroom and especially in the boardroom in positions of power. One of the things that really excites me about working at Twitter that we don't see in incumbent media, and I've never really experienced, especially recently working on political campaigns, but especially in newsrooms, is how important culture is. And culture eats strategy for breakfast. So it's something to take a look at in newsroom culture. So for example, Twitter, as with a lot of tech companies, it's a very flat organization. So you could have someone really senior and you're sharing a desk space just right across from them. Great opportunities for collaboration, the ability to say yes and, to play, to experiment, to hack, and the opportunity to reflect the culture of what you're trying to do in your organization. And that's something I really value versus the more traditional top-down, super stressed out, everyone yelling at you, you're drinking coffee and you're lucky to have a job, look at all the resume, right? Like it's just a very different environment. And so I'd say take a look at in newsroom culture and what that means for the journalists who are there and then the impact it has on readers or listeners or viewers.
I mean, the culture piece is undeniably really, really important. That was, and I talked earlier about, you know, the ability to try things and test things, and I think a lot of newsrooms are trying to bring that more into their culture.
But there's still tension, right?
It's tough.
It's a fight.
Yeah, because I mean, for some people, they've been doing a job a certain way for a very long time, and if there isn't a clear path for them to say, well, here's your new job, and here's how it fits in with everything. Or to say to them, you're going to do this now, and in 3 months you may be doing something different. For somebody who's been doing the same thing for 10, 15, that's not a dismissive thing. That's very, very difficult for a human being to do. And like we've had it in Canada, you know, when we launched, we were doing one kind of thing with BuzzFeed Canada, and we've shifted since about June. We're doing a different kind of thing. And our two people on our team who are not journalists, who are part of the entertainment group, you know, they are part of a group that literally, I think, has shifted everyone's role and the makeup of their team about 3 times in the past since June. And it's actually a conscious experiment in trying different ways of putting different groups of people together, taking somebody who used to write posts for the site and do like lists and quizzes and things like that and saying, You're now creating content that is meant to just live on social media. Try that for the next 4 weeks. And like that's throwing people in on the deep end of doing things they're not used to doing. But you know, if you can roll with that, you'll learn a ton of stuff. And so, you know, that's a part of the culture I like. I think the other thing, frankly, which may sound silly, but I've learned is important, is we take silly things very seriously. And that goes on the entertainment side and it goes on the news side. So when there is, you know, a really hilarious meme and conversation happening on Twitter, like we will treat that like it's actually an important thing because we consider ourselves to be of the internet and we treat the internet like a really important thing, which I think it is. You know, for me, like Facebook, there's more than 1.7 billion people on that. That's one of the biggest stories in the world as far as I'm concerned. Like that's fucking crazy, okay? I'm sorry, but it's true. And so that piece of like not looking at it and dismissing it and seeing that, you know, there's fun stuff, but there's also serious stuff going on underneath, I think is really important. I think a lot of legacy newsrooms are paying a lot of attention to the internet, but I think there's still a very skeptical kind of eye about it, and you know, there's wonders to be had.
That's one of the most exciting things that I found working with quite frankly, younger people by advice is that they've got their ear to the ground and they know what's going on, and that's the world that they live in. And like I said earlier, not conditioning them out of that and thinking, oh, is this story big enough or important enough? And important enough to who? Does it matter to you? Then you know what? There's a good shot that you have that, you know, you can write about it and publish it, and maybe we'll even do a video on it. Doesn't mean that anything goes. We obviously, you know, don't approve everything. But having your ear close to things, because what I really like and what's healthy in that newsroom culture that you're talking about is where there's the possibility of anything being greenlit. And that we're talking about ideas and we're not talking about systems. And I think this is a bit of a disease that, to use the phrase digital disruption, which I accept, but I also have an issue with because it's not a disruption.
Disruption?
Yeah. Well, it's here. It's already been here. Like we're past it. So what's frustrating is when I hear about newsrooms that are constantly talking about mobile first or digital first. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, guys, we're there. Talk about story and just figure it out. Just do the journalism. The journalism should be at the center of everything. The story selection, what we should be talking about now. Don't waste half a day or a week or 2 weeks trying to decide if it should be long form traditional TV or, you know, just do the work.
I would, but I mean, I'm not sure you actually mean that because you know when you conceive of a story, you also, I mean, you will execute and report that story differently depending on how it's going to be delivered.
But at Vice, we are agnostic around what platform it is. So we'll often just say, well, that's just a short print piece, or that's a video piece, or we're going to work on that one for 2 months and roll it out as a special project.
Sure, but you're not going to go get a whole bunch of video and go, oh, you know what, this is actually a print piece.
But we aren't beholden to filling certain kind of slots. And I think that's a freedom that we have at Vice, so that if we want to quickly turn something around a certain way, that we can. And I feel like that's something that every newsroom now has at their fingertips because they are all playing in the digital space. And they should be more confident around taking those risks about having things appear in a different place and maybe only appearing in one place. I mean, that's not such a crazy idea that, you know, that things are diluted and that it's in TV in one place and radio in another and socials in another. Maybe all that it is, and we have this conversation all the time, that's just a little quick socials thing. That's actually two lines, or that's a 40-second video, and it's only going to live there.
But that is key, that question, because it comes back to value. So I remember when I was doing my degree at Concordia in Journalism Communications, I was in the TV section of the cohort, and it was film, TV, audio, yeah. Because the film folks were like, we are film. And they were above us. And us TV people were like, ha, you're lucky if we even broadcast your film on TV and people watch it here in Canada. And then the audio people laugh, like, no one can hear your TV or film. Good luck, right? But that was the hierarchy. Then you actually get into a newsroom. When you work as a broadcast journalist, as a reporter, producer, all the print journalists, and at CBC, all the radio journalists are like, TV, hair and teeth, excuse me, right? And they are just so much better than television. Then you move to online, and you try to book someone and they go, oh, it's just for online, right? So there is a hierarchy,
there
it
is.
Still exists, and incumbent print journalists are fighting to maintain that hierarchy. But I do think we have a generation of people coming up, and I think it's beyond generational, actually, where the source, whether that is a tweet or a long-form documentary or a podcast or the evening news, is not as important as the story itself and where that's coming from and what it's saying. So gone are the days where people, I'd say this new generation coming up, are like, oh, let me see what the newspaper says, or I'm going to come home and watch the evening news. Rather, you're getting lots of different sources from different mediums, and you're putting that together for your media diet. And yeah, there's some challenges with that, but I think ultimately that's what makes it exciting to be someone who is consuming the news right now, is there's so much choice from all around the world.
For what it's worth, at the Globe and Mail, we don't care what platform you watch us on or read us on or receive us on, as long as you give us money. So in a couple
the
of minutes...
The platform is money.
The platform, yes, that's right. We're going to take questions from the audience in a couple minutes, right there in the middle, so you can make your way there if you want. But first, I'm going to ask one more question. So, one of the reasons legacy media are sometimes envious of you guys is because we look at you and we see, you know, the audience, and it's, you're growing, and that's fantastic. But just as a reminder, I mean, Twitter was for sale, reportedly for sale, for a while, and, mm-hmm. you know, nobody bought it. Mm-hmm. BuzzFeed reportedly missed its revenue targets. Certainly, it's still privately held. There are suggestions that, you know, that we're not sure.
What are the suggestions?
Where all
in,
the
man.
Money comes from.
What's happening?
We're all reading the same stories. We also don't know.
People are saying.
Sources.
And Michael. And Michael, today, obviously, you when you were asked at a Canadian Heritage hearing, committee hearing about profitability, you, I didn't, don't, not sure. You didn't
you
actually
tweeted
quite answer the question. So you
I
noted,
did answer the question.
Are we profitable? We are privately held.
Oh, good job.
So we're the Globe and Mail, for the record, the Globe and Mail is also privately held and profitable. So business models, can we learn, should we learn something from the three of you?
I'll jump in, and I think that with BuzzFeed, we probably share this a little bit. At the end of the day, Vice is a global play. So that's something that's very different from what's going on with domestic news and content agencies, in the sense that stories that do well for us domestically and stories that do well globally, there's just that much more audience and eyeballs and production dollars to be able to support that. So I will answer your question, but I'm not going to go all the way. Because there's only so, to be honest, there's only so much insight that I personally have into all this, but we have a very diverse funding structure, and we're in such massive growth mode right now, and we're valued at over $4 billion. If you want to read all the articles about a looming IPO and all of those sorts of rumors. But at the end of the day, we're getting money from a lot of different places. So in Canada, we have a joint venture with Rogers. We've got a huge investment right now through HBO. We do have ad revenue that's coming in through all those, what I would actually consider that a traditional revenue model. I realize it's a new revenue model for many other places. And we're expanding and growing. So I'm not going to answer whether we're profitable or not, because we're investing constantly in our growth. We do have to look back at ourselves in the next couple of years and say, have we put our money in the right places? Do we need to pull back in a couple areas? And that's a reckoning that every company may have to go through. But we're not at a place where we've established what a sustained model is, so that it makes sense to say, okay, this is what we are, and we're hitting our targets. Because right now, we're just growing. Like, I can't keep up with the number of countries where we're expanding in right now. So it doesn't make sense to say, okay, are we there? Do we have success yet?
Okay.
So when I started at Twitter just 2.5 months ago, I was in San Francisco for training. That's where our headquarters are. And I met up with a friend of mine from school who works at a venture capitalist firm. And I was just asking him for his take on Silicon Valley and what it's like working there. And he kind of like gave me the lay of the land. And he said, there's a lot of movement to like the next great exciting startup. And you're going to see a lot of people who like work at a company for 2 years and then they're out. And he said, what's really interesting about Twitter right now is you're no longer early stage. You're not a startup. You're 10 years old. You're mid-stage. And that's a unique opportunity. So you're going to see some people who want to come in for the challenges that come along with that because you're still trying to grow your business. And some other folks want to be, oh, it's Snapchat right now, or it's something you've never even heard of, right? And they want to get in there because there's an excitement when you're building something. So yeah, we are growing our business, and that means taking a look at everything from video and live to acquisitions to user growth, and that to me is a unique opportunity with the job, is that we're 10 years old.
Do you want to know?
Yeah, so a couple things. So one, Michael mentioned scale. Vice and BuzzFeed are two of, if not the two largest kind of international digital-only operations. I don't think there's room for a lot of those. And so that kind of scale is only going to be achieved by a few people, and there's some opportunities that come from that. And I think one of the opportunities that's happening for us as a result of that scale and the audience we have is we actually have managed the amazing thing of getting the platforms to pay us, which is, I think, the dream of a lot of news organizations right now. Like, Twitter paid us to do the election night thing. Facebook pays BuzzFeed to produce live video. They don't tell us what to produce, but there's an agreement there. And I actually do think that the platforms are going to start paying more and putting more money into play. Google is already putting money in Europe, partly because the EU has pressured the hell out of them to do so, which may be a model for Canada as well. But I think that particularly when you look at digital advertising, Facebook and Google own more than 80% of that market. So if you have a website and you're running, you know, basic display ads on it, you know, you're dealing with them, and they're going to kick your ass is probably the truth of it, unless you have a very small focused organization. And so Vice and BuzzFeed do a lot of sponsored content where large companies pay a fair amount of money to get things created that live on our platforms and that make use of kind of, you know, what we've learned about it. And so, you know, revenue diversification of getting it from platforms, of doing it with sponsored content. Today, I believe, on BuzzFeed, if you go, there's a banner advertising some kind of tool for using cheese. I forget what it's called. What is it called?
Fondoodle.
Fondoodle. Okay, so I just found this out today. Apparently, the entertainment side, or whatever side this is, acquired this cheese-making tool and the company that came up with it, and now BuzzFeed owns that, and BuzzFeed is going to be working with them to create a whole bunch of other products that you can imagine. We have Tasty, we have a lot of food stuff, suddenly we've got products in there. So, like, we're trying to figure out as many possible ways to get money as possible. We do want to grow as fast as possible. In Canada, we're very small, but we are profitable, I guess I could say. We're 11 people. The revenue is well into the millions. We actually had revenue before we hired any editorial people here as well. So on that side, it's going well. But I think figuring out where big amounts of revenue come from, it's not going to be one place. It's going to be stacking a whole bunch of things together. And I think that's what everybody in media is figuring out now. Like, it's whether you still take advertising. You've got a paywall now. You know, I think you do
it's
events.
It's a subscription model. Okay. Paywall is so
it's
2014.
It's unlimited. Yes. But everybody's trying to do it. You know, what is it? The Toronto Star, don't they have a wine? Coffee club. They have a coffee club. Listen,
yeah.
New York Times was selling wine years ago. So don't crap on the Star for doing that, okay? That's what I would say. Everybody's trying to get paid. That's just the deal.
We tried to get into beer. I don't know what happened with that deal. I think we'll be trying it again, though. Yeah, it's true.
Hipster craft beer.
Yeah.
So the Fondoodle, now that question on your site makes sense, which would you rather give up cheese or oral sex? So, I'm not making this up. This was on BuzzFeed.
Simon, I told you, if you mentioned a quiz, you had to give us the answer of you having taken it. Okay?
Later at the reception.
Okay.
So, we do have the microphone right there. As you make your way to it, if you have any questions, I'm going to ask one more question since none of you is there yet. So, please use the microphone provided for the benefit
of the
audience.
Ask me about the Fondoodle.
Here in the room. Please tell us your name and affiliation, and more importantly, I'm told you should please ensure that your questions are brief and in the form of a question. And while we're getting, oh, here we go, okay.
Hi.
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 I'm Nanaba Duncan. I am a host and a producer at CBC Radio. Who do you think are today's newest digital disruptors? And based on your experience, do you keep an eye on them? Do you have plans to work with them?
Good question.
Very good question.
Why are you guys looking at me? Oh my God. It seems passe now for me to say this, but if you look at what Al Jazeera's AJ Plus and Now This have done, really pioneering a video format on Facebook that works when you're not using audio and all, like I think what they've been doing is really interesting. That's what came to mind, but I also feel like that was a year ago, you know?
Well, this is why you always need young people around you. Like one of the great things working on political campaigns is you get to like befriend teenagers, and I always keep a couple teenagers close. And I had a teenager who got me on Snapchat a couple years ago when it was a bit, I thought, scandalous to be on Snapchat. And I'm so happy that now I feel like Snapchat is super mainstream, and it looks like they're gonna, IPO. But one of the things I've been inspired by, and a shout out actually to Naba, because she has a podcast called Media Girlfriends, is the rise of podcasts. And even though podcasts aren't new, I mean, they've been around for a decade, the amount of podcasts and the level of production and the voices, it's how I got through this election season, was listening to podcasts. And there's just so many incredible hosts and storytellers out there. And that's something I've been like following pretty closely, and the fact that it's so accessible now. And the other thing I watch very closely are hashtags, and seeing the movements that come up on Twitter and how people are coming together and organizing. And that can lead to anything from a community to an occupation to something that you know, turns into an idea or a business. So I'm always looking close to see kind of what's trending and what people are talking about that has yet to hit the mainstream.
I follow hashtags too, and so far nobody's asked any questions on CJF JTalk. So not as far as I can tell. So shall we, Michael, unless you wanted to answer the...
No, my answer was just going to be writers and voices.
Oh, there you go.
Just talent, like individual talent. That's what we're looking for. And we get a lot of people in. We do development work. We have a development team that's developing ideas and mostly focused on shows. But we bring people in that way. On the writing side, we're working with freelancers all the time. And we're hungry to find those diverse voices. And we've just made a few great hires that I'm really proud of, where you saw people who were killing it, and they were good, and so we hired them. And we'll keep doing that.
Hi. So full disclosure, I work for Craig at BuzzFeed Canada.
Lauren, please be good, okay? Be good
to me. Do you know that your socks match also?
It's true. It's polka dot day.
Oh, my God.
Okay, so I have a question. So you guys touched upon this just a little bit regarding sort of cultural disruption and diversity. It seems to me if you look at digital companies, especially in leadership, they still look largely the same as traditional media, which is funny to ask whether your organizations are mainstream or not, because they look very mainstream. So my question is, can you really have disruption without diversity, and are you perhaps having a very sort of narrow and lazy definition of what disruption really is?
I knew she was going to bring the hammer.
Yeah, so yes, you're right. You're right. I think one of the things that frustrates me greatly about the tech community in Silicon Valley is it's the sons of traditional mainstream media. So yeah, the white guys are wearing hoodies now. So it's an issue. I think one of the things that has inspired me is on platforms like Twitter, there have been activists and journalists and racialized people calling out companies like Twitter, calling out mainstream media and saying, show us your numbers. And that's something that Twitter responded to and said, here are our numbers, here's what our company looks like, here are our targets, and have created policies and groups within the organization to address that. I know just today there were a few emails within the company in terms of the diversity outreach we're doing on university campuses. So I know that's something a lot of incumbent media and organizations like the CBC have been very reluctant to share those numbers, but we're seeing that. And again, it's coming up from social media. So it's not going to come from the top down. We're going to have to to push for it. We're going to have to call people in. And that, to me, is one of the most exciting things I've witnessed as someone who used to be in the newsroom. So I remember being in television newsrooms, and you always see the diversity issue based on the stories being pitched, right? And that's gender, and that's race, and it's class. And it's also, even in a Toronto newsroom, where you're from in the country, if you're working on a national show. And now more and more, what's so beautiful, especially about Twitter and things that are trending, is when something's been trending for a day, 2 days, a week, it's hard to ignore. And I think it was really embarrassing that the Globe and Mail was so slow to respond to cover Black Lives Matter Toronto, for example, and not just the Globe and Mail, but other traditional media outlets when the story was dominating Twitter and it was really capturing something in Toronto. So that's, I think, what's changing. But yeah, we need to see it in positions of power. Absolutely.
So we release an annual report of the diversity within the company, and 100% at the managerial level, I think that's one of the biggest areas where you're not seeing people able to move up, and that's something that's consciously being addressed inside the company. I mean, for us in Canada, we're small, so if I was able to hire a lot of people, it would be a wonderful thing to be able to bring that. So we try to think about who's not represented in our office right now and figure out ways where we can talk to people to help kind of fill our gaps, our ignorance on certain things. It's a huge issue in media. There's no question about it. And I think releasing the stats every year is a good start, but you can also sort of just pat yourself on the back by doing it. It's like, well, we released them, but it's also a question of like, well, what progress has been made in a year? And so that's something that I think people need to hold the feet to the fire on.
Unless you're dying to answer that, we could move on.
Well, I do want to answer because I think I mentioned it earlier. Like, it's a major issue. But you're specifically zooming in on leadership, and we've got work to do there. And a lot of work to do. Part of growing is that hopefully a lot of the people that are in leadership positions at a company like Vice will be getting out of the way, and that will happen.
Do you mean they're going to die?
Well,
are you
gonna
resigning die on stage right now?
I am
now?
Quitting right now. Happened? I'm retiring. Yes. No, but that'll happen. It takes time, but I really
and money.
It takes time and money. Yes.
And investing in women and investing in racialized voices, because the ideas are out there. They're just stolen, and people profit from them.
But we have to support those. I'm often thinking, just about who the next person is behind every job. I'll often think about that. As you look through your company, and we'll be close soon. But I think it really does come to story selection. I just want to throw in, we are quite proud of our work at Vice around some Indigenous issues, and have a fair number of Indigenous reporters, producers, directors working with us. And I hear from them every day about their shock at the lack of coverage of what's going on in Standing Rock from mainstream media. It is truly just connected to the fact that people who aren't paying attention to that story in the way they should be paying attention to it, maybe they're noticing it, but they're putting it through a Washington climate change pipeline economic lens, as opposed to a social and spiritual justice lens, which is how it's being put through by our Indigenous reporters. And that's a gap that pains me when I have those conversations, because I don't have enough people that I can just, and we've had this conversation with our reporters. We can't just send everybody everywhere, but we do need to work at the leadership level, because stories like that start to slip through.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Adir Kraftman. I work for the Center for Israel and Jewish Affairs. I have a question. You spoke about the new anti-harassment tools at Twitter, and I want to take us for a minute back to that dark side of the internet. We've been dealing with an individual up in Markham who's been dubbed the biggest anti-Semite on YouTube. I see some people shaking their heads. We estimate that their monetization of their videos was in the tens, if not hundreds of thousands, over the last 3 years. And that was until YouTube took down their videos, and now they're being reshared. So where do you see the future of, especially in the context of after the US election, the future of tools, online tools for Twitter, for YouTube, in responding to extreme right videos and white supremacist, homophobic activity, etc.?
Anybody want to take that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the biggest questions and stories right now. I mean, even how the mainstream media is covering Donald Trump's administration as it builds out, and what words they're using and what words they're not using. And
do you mean white supremacist?
Yeah, or white nationalist.
Sure.
And what makes the headline and what doesn't. I think those are really big questions. I also think that we're dealing with an angel complex here in Canada, where we think it's not here and it's just...
It is here,
yeah. And we've seen those examples again, like on social media, where it's like, you know, hey, white person, right? Like that going viral, yeah. and people sharing those stories. We also lived through the Ford years here in Toronto, and there's many other examples. You know, I grew up in St. Catharines, Ontario, where I knew people who were part of the neo-Nazi movement, and they didn't go away, right? They're in cities and municipalities across the country. So I think the larger question right now that we're all trying to wrap our heads around, whether it's social media or mainstream media, is the victory of Donald Trump and the role the quote-unquote alt-right played in that campaign. And how do we create space for democracy while at the same time not normalizing hate?
But there's so much journalism that needs to be done right now about this. And so I, like a lot of people, spent a lot of the last week quite frankly pissed off at a lot of things in the world, but including you know, some questions about our industry, and I don't mean to be all Pollyanna about it, but I'm really inspired right now, and I'm inspired by leadership advice. You know, Shane Smith wrote us all a big note a couple days later saying, guys, now is not the time to go and, you know, drink a few too many and cry in your hoodie. He didn't say that, but that would work.
Oh, yes, he did. That yeah. Sounds like, yeah.
Like, we've got work to do. It's been like, there's a light that's been shone into the corner right now, and we can see it, but we still can't make sense of it. And it's our job to do that. And you know, I it's a challenge that we've issued to our staff at Vice in Canada. It's been issued to our staff across the U.S. I heard it in several meetings last week. And I would urge every journalist to pay attention to the undercurrents of the world and not just focus on the things that matter to them.
Sorry, this is Shane Smith, who took a lot of money from Rupert Murdoch, who owns HarperCollins, which published some books rooted in work by Steve Bannon, Breitbart. I just want to clarify. This is the Shane Smith we're talking about, right? Guy who, Rupert Murdoch, Fox News, I don't think I need to. I'm just, for the record, this is what we're talking about?
You sound like one of those conspiracy theorists now.
I'm just pointing out some facts. If you can draw the lines to... No, no. So this is Shane? That's the Shane.
Yeah, that's the Shane. I mean, okay. If you want to draw dotted lines between things, you can. But you can also draw a dotted line to the incredible work that Shane has led at Vice and will continue to around stuff like this.
Yeah.
But I have to say the lines are important. We all need to be drawing those lines.
Wait, where'd our last questioner go? We scared him away. Are there really no other questions? Because I've got some more, and I know that the panel doesn't want to hear them. We do have some. It's up to me. Up to me. Okay. Well, because I'm the oldest on the panel, I have to do this.
Oh,
how old are you, Simon?
I'm 49, and I'd give up cheese.
Thank you.
I started drinking about 4 o'clock this afternoon. Okay. So this is for Michael. I wouldn't give up cheese. If Nice cuts through the bullshit, why didn't they get to Trump supporters? Does Nice cut through the bullshit?
You mean Vice.
Oh, if Vice, I apologize. I like
that'd
Nice.
That'd be a whole other thing called Nice. Nice.com. Nicenews.com.
It's more of like Oprah's millennial brand. Yeah.
I mean, we're not responsible for that on our own. We did some really good reporting. An unfortunate, to be really blunt, we promised ourselves we'd be blunt. I hope you guys feel like we have been. We went through a huge news restructuring at a really bad time. It's a bad excuse, but we were growing and restructuring and launching our news show during the U.S. election, and I don't think that we had our foot on the pedal as aggressively as we should have through our U.S. political coverage. And that said, in Canada, I felt like we did an incredible job during our federal coverage coverage last year. But I think a lot of newsrooms are asking themselves that question, like, what did were we spending too much time listening to ourselves? And there are lessons to be learned there.
So I think there are lessons around the failure to report on and examine systems and policies that created a lot of this. But also, too, I think something I've been reflecting on, I think one of the unique pieces of Twitter is that you actually can connect with people with different points of view, but often we don't take seriously that other point of view, right? We don't take seriously what someone is saying that we disagree with. I remember, you know, a lot of people even saying with Trump, like, oh, he's not serious about whatever it was he's saying, and people are still saying that. So how do we listen? That's something I think we all have to ask ourselves. How do we listen?
Yes.
Yeah, so I sent out that tweet, and I think one of the things that I find kind of confounding, and this is maybe a question for you, I know that a lot of us probably joke around about our parents being on Facebook and the things that they post, and a lot of that information isn't necessarily available, like how much you know, certain stories or certain things are being said. There's a lot of information that obviously Facebook, Twitter, for privacy issues, doesn't want to release, but they would be the people to know that information the most. So, you know, a lot of older people, kind of social media almost is like a whiplash, has kind of disrupted the way that they get media, than that they get the news. And we didn't know that that's how they were thinking this entire time, and that they were going to willingly vote for this man. And we were all sitting around talking to each other, pretty much saying, like, oh, this Donald Trump thing isn't going to happen. So is there any idea of, like, how you might tap into that data to maybe share what a certain demographic is actually thinking that they might not publicly share at the coffee shop or at work or something? Do you get the gist of my question?
Sure, yeah. One of the things I did a lot of during the campaign was share data around the debates and on Election Day in regards to what people were saying on Twitter as connected to Donald Trump's campaign, Hillary Clinton's campaign, the top policy issues, hashtags, etc. What's really difficult is just because someone is talking about a candidate or talking about an issue, there's like no evidence that that means that campaign is going to win. Like, I've worked on political campaigns where we had the best social media campaign and we came in third, right? And that's what's super tricky is there was a new playbook in this election. There were also other factors like voter suppression and other underreported stories. So it's a real mixture, and I think that's what I love and hate about politics, is it's never one thing that wins a campaign, and it's never one thing that sinks a campaign. So we do our best to share our insights and share our data from Twitter, but all we can do is say, this is what people are saying on Twitter. We can't connect it to a conclusion until we see how people vote. But definitely there's a lot of room to grow in figuring out how we have conversations with each other, whether it's in the coffee shop, on Twitter, or I'm going to Cleveland to visit my family for U.S. Thanksgiving, and that's sure to be a lively dinner.
There was a Medium post by a woman named Erin Pettigrew. She used to work at Gawker Media in the U.S. She dug into Facebook's, so Facebook releases very little data overall, and in fact they've closed off a bunch of APIs that were useful. But where Facebook actually gives a fair amount of data is on the advertising side. So if you're trying to buy an ad and you're trying to target certain people, Facebook suddenly starts to open the kimono a little bit and show you things. And so Erin saw that Facebook could actually show you how many people had, you know, quote unquote, an interest in Donald Trump. And that amount was greatly significant compared to Hillary Clinton. And so she wrote an interesting piece looking at this, but there's no sentiment attached to interest. You don't know if they had, like, was it because they talked about how much they hate Donald Trump every single day on Facebook? Was it because they had liked a bunch of pages that were pro-Trump? You don't get down to the next level, and there's a kind of a hope and a desire a solutionism, you know, that happens where you think, well, if we just had a little bit more data, we'll know. And you know, we could see everything that Facebook has. And it may not explain everything. But what we do have right now, for sure, particularly from Facebook, is a lack of data. And, you know, I'm very focused on what's happened with kind of fake news and misleading stuff in this election in particular. And I'm doing my best to cobble data together from a bunch of different sources, but it's not there. And I think people saying that fake news gave Trump the election is wrong. It's like it's too easy of a solution, and there's no one answer. But certainly, if we had more data, there would be interesting things to look at. But we also have to be wary of thinking that the answer is lying in there, because at the end of the day, it comes back to humans. There is the question about harassment and what's the future of technology for dealing with harassment. At the end of the day, it's going to come down to a human, in a lot of cases, making a call on that. When Facebook removes a photo because it's copyright infringement or because it's graphic violence or what have you, that's because a human flagged it and another human reviewed it in a lot of cases. They have some automation, but in the end, it's still human decisions, whether it's voting or, you know, choosing whether to block an account on Twitter. A lot of times it comes down to humans again, even though there's so much technology there.
And humans are so annoying.
Yeah, we're terrible.
I had not read that piece by Aaron Prendergrup. It's kind of astonishing to me that advertisers might want to target, might think that they're buying one particular kind of view, that is to say a Trump supporter, when in fact they're buying a Trump hater.
Potentially.
And vice versa.
And Facebook recently got into big trouble because they were allowing people to exclude certain racial groups. In buying advertising, and they just closed that loophole, but that's only because ProPublica did a story. Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, that's, you know, for me, that's why I think it's like one of the most important stories out there, not diminishing others, but it's just like there's a lot going on there.
And why organizations like ProPublica do such vital work.
Yeah, yeah.
So we're just about out of time. We'll take one more question from the floor.
I'm James Rubeck from Cision Canada. We're very large partners with Twitter, so we have access to the full Twitter firehouse. We did a lot of analyses over the election, but also about Brexit. So after Brexit, we saw an increase in, I'll say just intolerant term use, and you can extrapolate what that means, of 671% after the Brexit vote. During the election, we saw an increase just across the United States, 3,000% increase between 2015 versus 2016 in intolerant language use. That's a lot of people. It's not just, you know, we talk about the dark side of the media. Those are millions and millions of people, you know, 20%, maybe 10%, even any number around that, that's huge. What are your media organizations doing, or what are is your social network going to do to engage with, inform, and tell stories that persuade these people that the way they look at the world might be wrong? Maybe what we were all trying to do the last little while doesn't work. So I'd love to hear ideas on how you're going to affect these people in the future.
I mean, it's a huge challenge. And to be honest with you, there's decades and decades of psychological research and in other areas that tells you it's extremely difficult to change somebody's mind. And as much as we have a job to do in a lot of areas of informing people and saying what's going on, if at the end of the day the mission is to change people's minds, you know, I don't think journalism on its own is enough for that. And it comes down to, you know, the research that's out there about it is if you actually want to move somebody off of their position, the first thing is you have to give them a way to let go of that position and not feel like they're being threatened. And a lot of times, you know, you have to condemn hate. But if you're condemning the haters, then they're going to put you in that category and they won't engage with you anymore. So in some cases, it's a lost cause. And you also don't want to give more exposure to those voices at some times as well. So I think there's really tough decisions. I don't have an answer for it. But I know that if we're trying to change people's minds, it's really, really difficult to do. And journalism alone isn't going to necessarily do that. I know for us, we have somebody who's been covering the alt-right for, I think, more than a year now. You know, we're trying to think about deploying different people on different beats. We have at least a couple people who are dedicated in covering Islamophobia around the world, people in France, people in other places. And so we're thinking not just about trying to change those people's minds, but also trying to cover the communities that in many cases are at risk or at threat or are dealing with, you know, the blowback from what those folks you're talking about are doing.
So back to Craig's point around the humans of the internet. That's something I think a lot about, which is the larger systemic and policy change that's required. So for example, around abuse and harassment on social media, if you talk to someone who is faced abuse, and she, and it'll likely be a she, will say, if someone comes up to you face to face and says, I'm going to kill you, and you call police, the police will take that very seriously, and they know how to take action. Whereas if you call the police and say, someone just threatened to kill me, where it was in a comment or, right, it was on social media, they're not quite sure what to do or what that looks like. And especially if that came from another city or another country. But we have to address these issues and take a deeper look at the systems and policies that allow this culture to exist. And I think that's what we're staring at right now with the election of Donald Trump. And it's very interesting talking to Canadians about the election of Donald Trump, because there seems to be this general consensus of how did that happen? But when you speak to Americans, especially if you have family or friends in swing states, and if they trust you, the conversations are much different. And actually, when you dig really deep, it starts coming back to economic policies and public education and like much larger issues. So I think we actually have to go much bigger while still committed to the work that we're all trying to do and the belief that journalism matters and it's essential part of a healthy democracy. But I actually think we need much larger systemic change to actually do the work.
Michael, did you want to address that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we've got a war against noise right now. There's so much that doesn't cut through, and that's an opportunity for journalism. It's an opportunity for policy. But finding ways to give weight and turn up the brightness on certain flashlights so that things aren't all the same size. And putting that investigative work into things. And it takes a lot of work to do that. And I'm not saying that one piece by Vice and a project by Twitter and an initiative by BuzzFeed mixed with a project from New York Times is going to add up to changing anyone's mind. But great journalism has slowly here and there affected policy. We see it day in and day out in our own country. And it affects who gets elected. If it's tapping into what matters and what people are thinking about, of course it has a job to do. But I think we're going to be writing and thinking about this for a long time in a bigger picture way. But in the meantime, I'm inspired right now as a journalist. Like I just when I was starting out, it was a very kind of counterculture, anti-corporation vibe as a young journalist. You were always going after the big banks or government.
Very
adbusters, yeah. And great shows like Undercurrents. Does everyone remember? Mm-hmm. If you
that
don't,
was a show
you
back
must
in the
know.
90s. It was once upon a time.
Bit of a connection there, and now I think we there's always different forms of what young journalists should be inspired by, and I think that every young journalist right now should be inspired by what happened last week to work on these stories and expose them.
And there's a great piece, if you haven't read it yet, by Jonathan Goldsby about what we learned from the Ford years, and it's a letter to America. And I think one of the pieces I took from it is like things are going to get much worse, but you're also going to see like an incredible side of people and community and activism. So
thank you. That brings our J Talk to a close. My name is Natalie Turvey. I'm executive director of the Canadian Journalism Foundation. On behalf of the CJF, it's my pleasure to thank our stellar panel, Michael, Jennifer, and Craig, for sharing what keeps them up at night, their challenges, along with their thoughts on how their platforms can build more impactful environments for news and storytelling. And our thanks as well to Simon Haupt. He is a rascal for leading tonight's discussion, lively and entertaining discussion. More importantly, for the work, Simon, you put into making this a timely and worthwhile talk. Please join me in a round of applause for our speakers. It's terrific to see a full house tonight. Thanks to all of you for coming out and supporting CJF J Talks. Coming up, we have a packed program. We're back on November 30th for a talk on the future of magazines. Against a backdrop of recent closures and reduced print schedules, we're joined by a panel of magazine executives and editors featuring Rick MacArthur of the venerable Harper's Magazine for a conversation on the challenges facing magazine journalism. On February 15th, on the heels of Inauguration Day, we tackle politics and democracy in America. We've landed three of the breakout media stars of the U.S. Election Press Corps. David Fahrenthold, Suzanne Craig, and Daniel Dale will join CBC's Neil MacDonald for a conversation on the media's role in the election and the rise of Donald Trump. And on February 16th, we convoy with that panel to Ottawa for a conversation at the National Arts Centre, moderated by the Globe and Mail's editor-in-chief, David Walmsley. February 22nd, we explore the changing face of media with an amazing lineup of speakers, including Sachi Kuhl, Ardy Patel, Hannah Sung, and Desmond Cole, who will speak to their roles in changing media to include more diverse voices. And on March 7th, in the lead up to International Women's Day, we tackle online harassment against women in media in partnership with the Canadian Women's Foundation. Heather Malik, Janet McFarland, and Catherine Porter will speak about the hazards of being a female journalist online and the policies and resources and tools that can help make newsrooms and online communities welcoming to all. You can look. You can check out our Twitter feed and Facebook for details on these events. I'd like to now invite you to stay with us and join us for the cocktail reception and continue the conversation with our panelists. Thanks, and have a great evening.